What's up, y'all? This is Lyrics Born, and when I'm not calling out to all area crew, I'm listening to Hard Knock Radio on free speech, listener-supported KPFA, the revolutionary station.
This is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. When I'm not throwing down on the floor of Congress, looking out and fighting for your rights, I'm listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We have somebody who's no stranger to our airwaves. Her name is Kat Brooks, and we were going to have Kat on this afternoon to talk to you about the recent revelations surrounding the Oakland Police Department and them not being under federal receivership and whatever that means. We planned to do this like on Friday. You know, I ran into Kat and we said, let's hook up and let's talk about this. Since that time, we've had President Joe Biden make this announcement that the police need to be more fully funded. And we also, unfortunately, saw, was it 5 or 6 mass shootings over the weekend, including the tragedy that took place in Buffalo, New York, where 10 people were killed, most of them Black. And it was targeted by somebody who is bought in to a theory about not being replaced. We don't want Black and brown people replacing us. And this 18-year-old kid went and did all kind of horrific acts and took out a lot of very good and hardworking people who have been fighting hard for our liberation. So, Kat, before we even talk about OPD and maybe you connect the dots, we'll see in the conversation. I just wanted to get your thoughts on what took place in Buffalo. I know you and others are planning on addressing that later this week, but I'll get your thoughts this afternoon.
You know, Davey, gosh, every time someone brings it up, I just start to cry. The reality is that hate crimes against Black people happen in this country every day, right? We just don't make headlines. Unless, of course, it is something this horrific where folks have to pay attention. And it wasn't just Black folks, right? These were our elders. And every time I think of the age of these folks, I think about how long they were living in a country where they had to survive violence, right, against their bodies, against people that look like them, probably against known, you know, family members, etc. And then our elders aren't even safe in this place. I mean, I guess to connect the dots, police would not have kept those people safe. Those people are not dead because there's not enough police, there are enough money being funneled into police departments. They're dead because America, this country, was born on and is run on a culture of anti-Blackness and white supremacy. I saw ABC World News reporter something that said that, you know, he was radicalized online. He wasn't radicalized online. He was groomed by America. And not that I wish death on anyone, even though I'm the first to admit that my abolitionist principles get real challenged when we have these moments. I do find it remarkable that this white boy was able to murder all of those Black folks and is still breathing.
Well, one of the things that we should keep in mind, he killed a cop, which is even more stunning.
Former cop.
But still, you know, when a former cop was killed here in Oakland, guarding a camera crew, they didn't say former cop, they said cop, and brought out every single resource to try and avenge that killing. And they made us remember that this individual was a cop. In this case, the narrative of if everybody's armed, we can disarm and we can stop this sort of mass occurrence. That's a narrative that goes out. The other narrative has been, if we just have more cops, literally a cop on every corner, we'll be safe. Well, you had somebody who was armed and trained and actually shot this assailant 4 or 5 times, only to find out that he was in full body armor and killed the cop. That's one thing. We did have a cop on every corner in a city that has not quote unquote defunded the police, and yet 10 people were killed. And so, you know, brings into question, as you said, what does safety really look like? What does the value of life really look like? And can people who are vulnerable really be protected? And it, and so far, you know, the answer to the last question, it's an obvious and resounding no. The fact that we had 5 or 6 mass shootings around this country that have been reported in 200 since the beginning of the year says that we're not safe. You know, there's just a lot that we have to wrap our heads around.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, one of the things that I've been saying as of late, Davey, is like, we can't use violence to achieve peace, right? Like, it doesn't work that way. And until we become a country whose values and actions and policies and practices are rooted in justice, equity, and humanity, we're going to continue to foster and breed violence, particularly as we continue to do that without really looking, not performatively looking at the impact of anti-Blackness and white supremacy in this country, and not just against Black bodies, right? Against brown bodies, indigenous bodies, queer bodies, Asian bodies. Until we do that, we're gonna be here. This is exactly where we're going to be. And as you mentioned, this was one of several mass shootings that took place across the country. And for me, that is a deep reflection of how sick emotionally, spiritually, mentally, psychologically we are as a country.
Well, in the case of this situation in Buffalo, they've already started the conversation about mental illness. And this is what this gentleman was suffering on, and that he had, made mention, you know, he's 18 years old. And that, you know, when he was in high school, he made notions of wanting to kill people. And one of the things, Kat, that I kept thinking about is that many Black kids who talk a lot in class and cut up and maybe even, you know, are a bit rambunctious or spirited, are usually sent immediately to the school to prison pipeline. You know, they're tracked in it, they're expelled, et cetera, et cetera. This guy threatened to kill people and he wasn't on that path. And makes you wonder how that was allowed to happen. Why he wasn't put in that pipeline, and two, if that was an indication of mental illness, do we need to reevaluate mental illness within our own community, since when Lil Ray Ray acts up, they're throwing away the book, whether he's 5 years old or whether he's 20 years old. And there's no conversation of mental illness, no excuse, no humanizing, none of that. It's just you're a criminal and throw away the key.
You know, Davey, a couple of points to that. One, when I said this country is sick, I wasn't talking about diagnosed mental illness. I was talking about white supremacy being a disease. Right.
Yeah.
That has taken root in all of us. Right. All of us are infected with this disease. And, you know, there's folks like you and me and some of our white friends who work on that illness every single day. But because it's considered OK here to hate Black folks, where we can literally elect a president, where 70 million people can vote for a president who hates Black folks and other folks of color, not once, but twice. Right. That many people voted for him. Yes, he lost, but I never let people forget how many Americans voted for him.
Yeah.
No one's addressing it that way, right? Because the ruling class of this country anyway doesn't look at it like it's a problem. And then the second thing is you're right, Davey. Little white boys are, you know, troubled, or they're just being kids, or, you know, that's a teenagers will be teenagers, or boys will be boys. And our Black children are criminalized, when the reality is that when we're talking about our Black children, a lot of times we are talking about diagnosed mental health problems that result directly from the conditions that that our children are brought up in, from living in a war zone, right? There's lots of research that show Black children as young as 5, 6, 7 being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. That is a mental health issue. It's one that I live with, that I take meds for. right? For those of us who have seen extreme violence and trauma. We teach our children that death in their communities is not only normal, but okay, right? Another day in the hood. And then we utilize the impact on their mental, emotional, psychological health that manifests sometimes in their behavior manifesting as violence acts as an excuse to lock them up and throw away the key.
Yeah, it feeds an ecosystem.
Yeah.
You know, an ecosystem that allows the building of jails versus schools, the ecosystem to fund police departments, which I want to get to with President Joe Biden's announcement, which allows entertainment companies, you know, to highlight those deaths and say this is a badge of authenticity. You know, let's rally around it and sell some units or, you know, fuel a program, et cetera, et cetera. So Black death is fuels this economy. Black criminality fuels the economy. Black trauma and tragedy is a form of entertainment and fuels this economy in so many levels. And it's, you know, brings to question, you know, what steps do you think we need to do to turn that around, or can we turn that around?
I don't know that I'm feeling like I have all the answers today, Davey. I mean, the only thing that I know how to do is to focus on healing for our people, force accountability, and to continue to organize, right? And I guess I would say more specifically than that, like one of my more recent theories, and it's not mine. I mean, people way smarter than me have been talking about this way longer than I have. But, you know, Davey, in the same way that the Panther Party understood that if you were focused on paying your light bill or your grumbling stomach, that you couldn't really focus on liberation or healing or raising a healthy family and thus birth the survival programs, I think that trauma acts as a similar inhibitor for Black folks. You know, that we are so busy putting our, like, if we really every day we woke up as Black folks and we really sat in what it means to live as a Black person in this country, I don't believe we could function, right? Those of us who do, air quotes, function. Perfect example, I was actually talking to our sister, Melina Abdullah, this morning. And when I got on her show, you know, she was weeping, sobbing about these murders, which of course in turn caused me to sob. But we had to very quickly, right, put that in a box so we could get on with the business of the day. And that is daily for Black folks. And so and until we are as focused on interrupting trauma as we are everything else we're doing, and I know that we're doing a lot, I feel that we're just putting gunshots on Band-Aid wounds.
Definitely sobering words and something to think about. Part of the healing is you all, a number of people are coming together to address some of this on Wednesday. Can you share with our listeners what that will be?
We are. So we're pulling this together rapidly, but we are going to gather at 6 p.m. at Oscar Grant Plaza for a program that will include some music and some speakers. But more importantly, we're in the process of bringing together healing practitioners in our community, right? So there'll be people there that folks can talk to, probably some massage work, some energy work, just to try to give people a place to process their pain, Black people in particular, a place to feel seen and cared for and heard. And talk about next steps. I mean, I see some folks at City Hall calling to make racism a public health issue. That's been declared a bazillion times, right? What actions are we going to take to say no more? Because as you well know, Davey, this isn't just happening in other parts of the country. This rise in white supremacy and white supremacist organizations and blatant acts of violence against Black and other bodies of color is very prominent in the Bay Area as well.
Yeah, no, it's happening all over. And as you said, people will declare that, but then we'll turn around and you'll look at policies. Let's close schools in Black neighborhoods. As you say that, you know, racism is a disease that needs to be addressed. Right. You know, let's say we'll see policies where police are running rampant and doing some of the things that are harmful. You'll see people actually aggressively campaign to overturn and reduce policies that we diagnose as a way to help heal and criminalize and lampoon them, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a lot of lip service. And then when the solutions are put in front of folks, they avoid that like the plague. Like that's a sickness to them, you know, having solutions come to fruition. So Wednesday at 6 o'clock, there will be a vigil and a gathering, you know, at Oscar Grant Plaza in front of City Hall. And we hope people come out with the mindset of healing and uplifting and building community. So with that being said, and I mentioned policies, Kat, let's talk about this other policy. A thorn in the side of Black people for a couple of centuries now have been police terror. It's an ongoing battle. It's a narrative that if you read newspapers all around the country, and I do, or if you have a TV set where you get to watch the news feeds from different cities, Greensboro, you know, Phoenix, Atlanta, Jackson, Mississippi, all these different cities, if you click it on, you'll hear the same narrative around police. And the narrative is usually set to say that the police are, one, feeling demoralized and underappreciated. They're saying it's in Jackson, Atlanta, Minneapolis, Chicago, Detroit. Pick a city. They're saying the same thing. Then they're saying that the defund movement has led to a rise in crime and we need more police. But in many of these places, it's actually against the law to reduce the police budget, and they've been well-funded for decades. And yet they still have the same narrative and quote-unquote challenges that we're facing in the Bay Area. And then lastly, there's a dismissal of the types of brutality that Black folks have experienced at the hands of police. And it's often, you know, presented as just a bad apple here and a bad apple there, and we just need more training and we just need to get rid of the bad apples. Yet nobody talks about all the laws that have been put in place, with the exception of maybe the Bay Area and one other place, where it's almost impossible to fire a bad apple cop. And then lastly, in places where we did circumvent that and put progressive people on city councils, progressive people in district attorney offices, you're seeing this wave to recall all those people and say that they're the cause for the narrative that the police is saying has been challenging for them. So let's talk about Oakland, because that's a front and center city that has been looked at all around the country. And where are we at with it? And what's the lens that you're viewing things through?
You're right. This is a phenomenon that we've seen around the country, but we can definitely talk about what happened here, right? What happened here was, in response to tens of thousands of Oaklanders calling for resources to be redirected from OPD's bloated budget, which gets well over half of the general funds that we could use for all of the things: housing for the unhoused, cleaning our streets, mental health services, you know, all of those things. And things that actually prevent crime, right? Jobs, education, trauma supports. Instead of hearing those calls, Libby Schaaf, who has never, not once in her political career, stood by any family of any Black person murdered by this department, proposed giving them an additional $56 million. Wow. On top of the well over $350 million that they get every single year. And then when you know, some warriors on our council, warriors for justice, like, you know, Sister Carol Fife, for example, fought and fought someone in Black folks that sit on council too, by the by, same ones calling racism in Oakland a public health problem, and got $18 million, a mere drop in the bucket, $18 million allocated for violence prevention. This should be something that everybody wants, right? Like if you're on one side of your neck saying there's so much crime and we've got to do everything we can to end this on the streets of Oakland, then you cannot on the other side of your neck say that investing in prevention is a dangerous thing to do for our city. But that is exactly what our police chief, LaRon Armstrong, said in partnership with Libby Schaaf. And not only that, he lied. He lied and said that it was because of defund that crime was rising up on the streets, ignoring all of the data and all of the facts, right? All of the cultural anthropology demonstrating clearly that the rise in violence was an exacerbation of pre-existing social conditions that collided with the economic pandemic that followed Corona. Lied for a year, went on Fox News that hates Black people, went on Fox News and told those lies. And that's where we found ourselves. Barry Donilon published, you know, op-eds naming me, naming Carol. It's our fault. Now, mind you, Davey, I don't know if
Barry Donilon is the head of the police Oakland union police in Oakland.
No, not union, association. Association. Police are not workers. Yeah. Right. yeah, put tourniquets on our backs, you know, to perpetuate this lie. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why would you do that? And that's because it's not about any interest in actually keeping our communities safe. It's about protecting their budgets, protecting their pensions, funding their liabilities. And you know, you need something in the coffer for all those claims that continue to come in around the Oakland Police Department. And yet this is the moral compass of Laron Armstrong that we're being told we should trust to guide us into an age of no federal oversight.
So what exactly is happening with this? The police, after 18 years, will not be overseen by federal monitors, or what does that look like now?
Well, it's been 20 years, right?
20 years, right.
Like just a real brief recap for folks, unless you're going to do this with another guest. In 2000, a rookie named Keith Batt, who had just been 3 weeks out of the academy, got placed with four training officers whose beat was mostly in the bottoms of West Oakland, right? Which at that time was still very, very, very Black and very, very, very poor. And for 3 weeks, he watched these officers rob community members, beat community members, write false reports, plant evidence, steal drugs, sell those drugs. And then, you know, he couldn't take it anymore. He told the truth and then he retired. Three of the four officers ended up standing trial. Oh, and they dubbed themselves the Riders, by the way.
They used their, that's how they named themselves.
Exactly. So this became the Riders scandal and ultimately the Riders court case. There were two criminal trials, both of those trials deadlocked with juries or charges got, you know, thrown out. John Burris and Jim Chanin, two civil rights attorneys, then brought a civil suit with 119 plaintiffs who agreed to not ask for very much money. The city only agreed to pay $10.9, I think, million dollars in exchange for the city and the Oakland Police Department entering into a negotiated settlement agreement with the federal government. And 51 tasks were laid out, everything from, you know, reducing use of force incidents to improving internal affairs, investigations, you know, putting an end to racial profiling, blah, blah, blah. This process was supposed to take 5 years. 20 years later. And mind you, at this time last year, they were still non-compliant with five tasks, including racial profiling and use of force incidents with community members. This time last year, a judge has now said, well, Jim and John argued without talking to any community members that OPD is ready to come out of federal oversight. So Judge Orrick, who's the federal judge that's been presiding over this case, said that can happen. But here's the catch. As long as OPD remains scandal-free and does not backslide on any of the tasks for a year. Well, OPD has never been scandal-free for a year. So some of my concern was a little diminished by that, right? Because there's no way they're going to make it. But that said, we can't completely let down our guard because they've been championing that for years, right? These are civil rights attorneys and mayor after mayor, and of course the police department, the police association, that even though they haven't gotten it all the way right, that they've come close enough. So we should let them off. And I imagine that after a year that I'll bet at least three scandals, that will be the rhetoric we hear once again.
What is the impact of this? What's the long-term or short-term impact you think this will happen? If Oakland has been a centerpiece, do people look at Oakland and say, well, if they can do it, let's follow suit and go down their path? And if there's dissatisfaction in the community, that's something that we're in theory going to have to swallow. Do you feel that maybe they did learn their lessons and will work hard to improve? When talking with Chief Armstrong, he said that he's been holding his officers accountable, and one of the challenges is that they have is that other police departments, where they're not being held accountable, are aggressively courting those officers, you know, basically saying, come over here to Vallejo or, you know, or some other place, and you won't have, you know, the sheriff department, you won't have the same, accountability measures, you know, that will stifle your work. So how are you seeing things?
It's funny that LaRon said that to you, because what he has said publicly is that other officer, that Oakland police officers were leaving because of the unwelcoming environment of defund. APTP had to uncover by combing through exit interviews that the department started doing last fall, that it was because these officers don't want to be held accountable. I would also note that it took him over a year to tell the truth about his department tear gassing children at the rally in response to the murder of George Floyd. A year. And that only happened again because it was uncovered, right? In 2020, 2021, the majority of routine traffic stops, Black and Latino drivers. Not too long ago, it was revealed that police officers were not actually reporting when they engaged with, you know, use of force on community members. LaRon covered all that up. I think in terms of long and short-term impacts, I think that they are going to try their best to be on point for a year, because they want out of oversight. Cops do not like being overseen, and they certainly don't like being told what to do, right? So I imagine that they're going to try. I do not think that they'll be successful. Oh, I forgot, you know, we're still in the middle of seeing what the fallout for that racist, misogynistic Instagram account are going to be.
What was that account, for people who don't know?
It was a Instagram account. I don't know what it's called. I don't go look at that trash, but it was said horrible things about Black folks and brown folks in particular. But there was also things about women and the LGBTQ community. And a lot of commentary about how, you know, that cops were not happy about the efforts to transform the police department.
Wow.
And that's sort of my point, Davey Ray. It's not one bad apple. It's the whole orchard. The very institution of policing is vital. And it was birthed out of racism and hatred of Black bodies. It still exists. Its job was to protect race-based capitalism then through violence. And that's its job now. And it's not going to stop doing its job. So the department, the police departments can't be fixed. Should be engaged in radical reforms to make them better until we can start over with something else that may actually work, for sure. But they can't be fixed. So absolutely. Here's where we are.
Definitely a challenge. And, you know, I come back to this, Cat Brooks, that we have to look at the playbook, because oftentimes police look at stats and they like to point out patterns and, you know, et cetera, to make their cases. And I think it's important to reemphasize, even as we focus on and fighting, you know, the issues that are before us. You just got off the phone with, you know, doing a show with Malina Abdullah down in L.A. It's the same narrative, and it's the same narrative in all these other cities. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, is all this popping up? Do all the police departments have low morale? All the police departments are resisting oversight? All these police departments have crime in their cities, even the ones that are well-funded, and they're saying it's because of the defund the police movement in Mississippi, throughout Texas, right, in Alabama. You know, go read these things. I'm not making this up, folks. You go Google it, look it up, and you'll see the articles. And, you know, and you're like, how's that happening? You know, and so it seems like there's something else afoot, that there's an agenda being pushed. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, Black folks are being used as fodder, a scapegoat, you know, a rallying cry, you know, for folks who want to see more authoritarian type of policies put in place. You know, we're just being blamed for something that is much, much larger than all that exists. And so, yeah, that's just my thoughts on it. As we close out, Kat, last comments from you, and anything you want to remind people about this Wednesday gathering?
Just for folks to please join us in Oscar Grant Plaza at 6 o'clock. Bring flowers, bring candles, bring your masks and sanitizer, particularly if you're going to want to get some work done by the healers that are there. And yeah, just join us. And for folks that aren't Black, this is a real good time for those of you who call yourselves allies to show up and be one.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he has allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yeah. You know what? Immortal Technique.
We got Clanks too.
Killer Mike.
I'm Terminator, nigga.
Brother Ali. No. Yeah. The ghetto is like a prison with invisible bars. No matter where you at, it always follow you where you are. And it's hard out there for a pimp to get out of, but it's harder for the hooker that he beat the shit out of. I got niggas underground in the Confederate States, ironically running from slavery that prison creates. So I never hate on the South, I respect their vision. I just hate on the niggas that promote Samboism and white execs that love to see us in that position. They reflect the stereotypes of America's vision. They want us dancing, cooning and hollering. Only respect us for playing sports and modeling. More than racism, it's stay in your places. And more people are trapped in practical Black racism. So fuck a civil war between the North and the South. It's between fields against enslaved that are stuck in the house.
Civil war for the soul of a nation. This is a struggle to save civilization. Demonstrations overthrowing the occupation. The annihilation of mental colonization. Civil war for the soul of a nation. We fight for the future of our civilizations. Destroy the corrupt government organizations. Trying to survive cultural assassination.
In blood, niggas, that saves Asians. Why the f*** we born with each other's population? The devil wanna dead all our population. People in folk nation, why the separation? Why we got Jamaicans hating on Haitians? When the British and French rape both nations, Mexicans and Blacks kill each other straight hating. Why the government profits from prison population? If you on the bottom, be you Anglo or Asian, you gotta recognize the realness in what I'm saying. You gotta recognize another G ain't the enemy. When the police ride and kill us frequently, we gotta make the youth see where the truth be. If you achieve, then grow and develop GD. 50 years of gains and our people still poor. If we really run the streets, we should really end war.
Civil war for the soul of a nation. This is a struggle to save civilization. Demonstrations overthrowing the occupation. The annihilation of mental colonization. Civil war for the soul of a nation. We fight for the future of our civilizations. Destroy the corrupt government organizations. Trying to survive cultural assassination.
Listen. Our hearts were torn apart just like y'all was. Watching towers full of souls fall to sawdust. Every time we called your office, you ignored us. Now you're holding hearings on us all inside of Congress. Microscopes on us, asking where you're hottest. My answer was in line with all of the founding fathers. I think Patrick said it best, give me liberty or death. I shall never accept anything less. You claim innocence, you play victimless. But you gave the kiss of death in the name of self-defense. Slavery and theft of the nations to the end of pacifying your citizenry with excess. We believe in freedom, justice, security, but they're only pure when they're applied universally. So certainly if I rage against the machine, my aim was only to clean the germs out of the circuitry. Urgently putting fear inside your heart, make you burn Qurans and tell me not to build a mosque. Me, my wife and babies, we ain't never made you hard. We just want to touch our head to the floor and
ask him to remove every blemish from a heart. The greatest threat of harm doesn't come from any bomb. The moment you refuse the human rights for just a few, what happens when that few includes you? Civil war.
Rich white men telling not rich white people that the problems are brown people. That goes back 400 years. All right? Back to the 1600s. What do we see in the colonies of what would become the United States? We see rich white people who are very, not even called, first of all, they're not called white yet. Because we hadn't created that yet. Right? We hadn't thought of that. See, that was some other stuff. We came up with that. We hadn't thought of that yet. We were just, there were some rich European people who owned all the land, and among them were what? African enslaved folks and European peasants, many of them indentured servants, right? Just one level above enslavement themselves. And they outnumbered the rich dramatically, in some places 5-1, 10-1, other places 2-1, but always outnumbered the rich. The rich were always a very small percentage. Just like right now, the top 0.1% of Americans owns the same amount of stuff as the bottom 90%. Wealth inequality is not really new. It's been the legacy of America. It might be more extreme right now than it's been in the contemporary period, but at the outset of the colonies, that was normative. So you had this handful of rich folks from Europe facing poor Europeans and African enslaved folks and indigenous peoples whose land they were seeking to conquer, and they began to realize something. They were like, holy hell, like this is not going to work forever. Like at some point, these folks are going to figure out that this is sort of shit for them. Like, they're going to want to take our stuff, right? Because they're going to realize we're hurting all of them, not just enslaved African folk and indigenous folk, but even these poor European folks. So what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? We got to come up with something, man. We got to have some kind of a game that we can run on them. What's the game? We got a game. We came up with a game. The game was called the white race, right? This game was called, let's create this new fictional thing. We're going to call all these European people white people. Now, you know that's like not real, right? You think that Europeans thought of themselves as one big happy family? This is what's so funny about these white nationalists that are coming out of the woodwork in the wake of the Trump campaign. They act like whiteness has some historical pedigree. The hell, you think Europeans loved each other? Man, we spent most of our time trying to kill each other. The English hated the Irish hated the English. Northern Italians didn't even think that Southern Italians were Italians. Germans hated everybody. And the world felt the same way about them. Europeans spent most of our time trying to kill each other, or in the colonies of what became the United States, trying to figure out who the witch was. That's the history of Europeans. You're a witch. Well, you're a warlock. Well, we're gonna burn you at the stake for not worshiping our Lord the right way. That's sort of what we did, right? So the idea that we were one big team called white people is absurd. Whiteness became a concept created for one reason only, and that was to succor poor, working class, immiserated, peasant Europeans into believing that they actually were on the same team as rich people. So if you tell them, oh, well, you know, you're white now. Oh, yeah, I know. Wow. We've been kicking your ass forever, but now we're going to put you on the slave patrol. Oh, yeah. We're going to give you a horse and a badge and a gun. And let you keep those black people in line for us, right? And these working class white folks on the slave patrol, the ancient precursor, if you will, to modern policing, right? Working class folks, see, because the police ain't rich and neither were the folks on a slave patrol. It was who rich people hired to protect their shit from everybody else. So you get these poor white folks, put them on a horse to control enslaved people to do what? To ask for their papers when you see them out. Let me see your papers. Let me see your identification. Who do you belong to? Ultimate stop and frisk, 16 and 1700 style. Racial profiling, 16 and 1700 style, right? Prove that you belong in this community. Show me that you're legitimately in this community. Prop 187, 1600 and 1700 style. Anti-immigration, 1600 and 1700 style. And it was poor and working class white folks that got pulled into that because what it made them feel like they're part of the team. Oh, I'm on the team now. I'm white now. For real, because these other white folks, they don't love you. They would starve you. They did back in the old country, but now they gave you a taste of power. They gave you what W.E.B. Du Bois called what? The psychological wage of whiteness. Right? And that won't pay your bills, but it'll make you feel better. It puffs you up, right? It's like, I may not have much, but at least I'm not black. I may not have much, but at least I'm not indigenous. I may not have much, but at least I'm not Mexican when we jack half of their country in a war of aggression that we started. I know that's not what they taught you in eighth grade, but that's how that actually went down. You may not have much, but at least you're not Chinese brought to work on the railroads and build them from dusk to dawn and dawn to dusk to build the transcontinental economy of this country. So you may not have much, but at least you're better than them, see? And so you create that mentality. You divide and conquer working class coalitions. You give European people just a little bit of taste of power and say, those are your enemy. And then that works for generations. And then we come up to the Civil War era, right? And it's still working, right? My folks from the South, I'm from the South, lived in the South all my life. And the only difference between those of us from the South and the rest of y'all is we know that our stinks, see? For real, like, those of us in the South who are white, we know we have an issue. White folks in California, not always clear on that, so y'all need to get clear. So the Confederacy decides what? These elite, rich, white landowners in the South decide they got to break away from the Union. And they made clear why they did it now. 150 years later, we lie about it. My people lie about it. We act like it wasn't about slavery. Oh, my goodness, no. Wasn't about that. It was about states' rights. Well, what right do you think they were fighting for, Buttercup? Do you think they were fighting for the right to determine the proper recipe for a mint julep? The proper way to smoke a pork butt? No, they were fighting for one right only, the right to own other human beings and to extend ownership into those newly conquered territories to the West as a result of that illegal war with Mexico, et cetera. So, had nothing to do with states' rights in the abstract. The Confederate leaders said so at the time. They said, Alexander Stevens, vice president of the Confederacy, the cornerstone of this new government is the idea, the great truth, that the Negro is not the equal of the white man. That's what he said. He didn't talk about trade policy. He didn't talk about tariffs. He didn't try to lard it up with a bunch of bullshit. He just said straight up it was white supremacy because they weren't ashamed at the time. Now we've reinvented history, act like that's not it. But at the time, they were clear. Now here's the trick, though. Here's the trick. This is where it gets crazy, because when you got a bunch of rich folks that are saying, we need to go to war to protect our property interest in human beings, but now we're not going to fight. Because rich people don't go to war. Rich people not gonna fight, whether it's in 1861 or in 1969. Rich folks don't go to war. Rich folks get doctors to write bullshit notes saying they have heel spurs so they don't have to go to war. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, Google that shit when we're done. Rich people don't ever fight to protect their stuff. Rich people don't believe in fighting, they believe in getting poor people to fight for them. Every time, every year, every generation, it's poor folks that get sent off to fight and die for rich folks' stuff. And so the rich in the South sent poor people, but how do you do that? How do you convince poor white people to go fight to protect your property interests in slaves? That's a tough trick, right? Because why would you do that, right? Like, why would you go fight for a rich person's property? Like, I'm not rich, but I got a nice house. And for those of you who were students, just because, like, you're students, I probably got more than you. So even though I'm not rich, right, I'm just saying, like, probably, you know, because I've been a little older. I've been around a minute. So if I were to call y'all up on the phone next week because there was, like, an enemy army invading my block or some shit, and I was like, hey, y'all, look, there's an army. They're coming. Yeah, they got tanks and they're about to take my stuff. But I don't feel like fighting because I just want to sit out on the back porch and have a drink. why don't y'all come and protect my stuff for me? You'd be like, yeah, I like the speech and all, Tim, but no. Like, that would be it. Like, you wouldn't do it. But these poor Southerners and working class Southerners without a pot to piss in the South, they went and fought, and hundreds of thousands of them died to protect the property of the rich. Why? Because the rich said, hey, if these folks get free, they're gonna take your job. No, fool, they already have your job. You get that, right? Because if you're white and you gotta charge a dollar a day to work on that farm, but the owner can get the black guy or the black woman to do it for free because they own them, guess who gets the gig? The free labor, right? Because people like free, right? Given a choice between free, don't cost me anything, and a dollar a day, guess what? The white guy didn't get the job. So in effect, white poor folks would have been better off to help overthrow the system of enslavement and white supremacy and work for a better economic deal. But rich white people held out that psychological wage of whiteness that said you may not have much, but at least you're above them. And then folks settle for that. Fast forward to the labor union movement. Same thing was happening. You had rich corporate owners that actually collaborated with some union leaders in many cases to keep unions segregated. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Why would a labor leader fall for that? Right? Because you got to think about it. But they did, because they would say, oh, well, we can't have black people and Mexicans and Chinese labor in our unions. It'll reduce the professionalism of the working class. No, fool. It'll double the size of your union. Right, which is sort of a good thing. Like when you go out on strike, it'd be good if you had more people, not fewer. Just like a math problem, you know. And also because if you don't bring people of color into your union, what's the boss gonna do? The very boss that encouraged you to fight amongst yourselves, that boss is gonna hire the very same black and brown folks that you didn't want in your union to replace your happy white ass. And then you're gonna get mad at who? The boss? No, you're gonna get mad at the black and brown labor who, quote unquote, took your job. See, some shit doesn't change. Rich white folks telling not rich white people that their jobs got taken by people of color. Fast forward to the present. We got somebody swearing that if we can just build that wall, just build that wall, just that one wall on the southern border, because we don't trip about this one. We just trip about this one, not that one. We're not worried. I guess we're not worried about crafty Canadians trying to figure out how to sneak into this country to take advantage of our superior health care. Right. We're just worried about these folks. But it's not about race. Remember, it's not about race. It's just about legal and illegal, even though 40% of the people in this country who were quote unquote undocumented didn't even cross the border. They're not undocumented at the time they cross any border. They came on legal visas, be they work visas or educational visas, overstayed those visas. A disproportionate number of those are not, in fact, from south of that border. They are overwhelmingly disproportionately from places like Canada, like Europe, not from Mexico, Central and South America, but we scapegoat some and not the others because, again, it's about rich white folks or presumptively rich white folks telling not rich white people that their problems are brown. It has nothing to do with facts. And by the way, the idea that if you build a wall, jobs are coming back for real, does anybody understand economics at all? Do you actually think that, like, the nation's capitalists are sitting around just waiting? They're like, holy shit, I hope they don't figure out that they could just build a wall. Do you actually think the capitalists are like, we've got them, we've been screwing them for years, we haven't been paying them right, we've been, you know, like, not giving them benefits, but if they build that wall, we're gonna have to give them all a raise. Really? Do you think that's how it works? You build a wall and then all of a sudden the jobs come back? No, the wall doesn't stop capital from moving. Neither does a tweet, by the way. An angry tweet doesn't actually cause a company to change its plans. If you think that an angry tweet makes a multinational corporation decide, oh, holy hell, well, he's mad at me on Twitter, so I guess we'll just keep the jobs here. You know nothing about economics at all, right? A tweet's not gonna change, neither is a wall gonna change capital mobilization. Capital's always gonna be free to cross borders. Goods are always going to be free to cross borders in search of the highest price, capital in search of the highest return. The only thing a wall does is chain labor to its country of origin. And if you have a policy that chains labor to its country of origin but allows capital to move wherever the hell it wants, so I can still move my company south of the border, I can still move to Sri Lanka to take advantage of less labor protection, environmental protection, etc., all you've done is tilt the game against labor permanently. And not just labor south of the border, but labor north of the border as well. Labor in this country would be far better off to have more folks here who were fighting for justice, who were fighting for better wages, who were fighting for better benefits, not something like a wall or a deportation policy that would limit the ability of those folks to mobilize for radical change. That is not a pro-worker policy, but it is very much in keeping with the mentality that says to those non-rich white folks, your problems are those people. And as long as we can keep folks thinking that, we're not dealing with the real problems. No.
Memorize like an abstract poet. If somebody asks who you are, well, you better know it, better know it, better know it.